Um?
54.
Okay.
4, I'm not sure.
I'll just look it up.
Yep.
Genau, 16 Uhr und 17 Uhr.
Ja.
Und zwar Demo für zwei Sachen. Eine Demo, das Ergebnis von the result of the workshop,
ist ja.
First Demo. And the second Demo is the Aeolus Demo.
Yeah.
And it's both, but you can tell also.
Yes, about it.
But it's probably a good idea.
You have a laser point?
He's looking.
Yes.
I'm not sure. I remember yesterday it was difficult because I don't know for what reason, but he's trying to
find.
Okay, ja, das finde ich wichtig zu hören. Okay, dass man es quasi nach dem Vortrag von uns, also jetzt vor dem Vortrag ist anzusagen, dann ist es unmöglich. Also nach dem Vortrag,
okay, fine. Yep. Yep. Okay. Does this work? Oh, yes.
So we just wait maybe until he acts on some individual minutes.
Yep.
And had another good night's rest?
Oh, not really. I still have to finish these slides. Slides for this presentation.
How many hours this time?
Oh, not too much. Just till 1 o'clock. So. But it was a quiet night, a quiet evening compared to the two previous ones.
Yeah.
This night will be something different, I think.
Definitely.
Yeah. It's on the second floor. I don't know the number of the room.
Okay,
but we assemble here and then we go up, yeah, because okay. We don't have access normally.
It's interesting that I didn't see that in the program.
Uh-huh. Yep.
I knew that there was a demonstration of the results we did yesterday.
Yeah.
Or you did yesterday.
That I still have to prepare.
Great.
The things are on the computer there, but I have to make scripts for them and so on, to make it work. Yeah. And when I put back the computer yesterday, the other workshop was still active, so I couldn't work on them then.
Mm.
But okay, we'll do this afternoon, no problem.
By the way, I'm
sorry sometimes during your workshop I dropped out of the book. It just was too really, too much.
Uh-huh.
Too much date.
Yeah, but
and, well,
of course it's
too few of the night hours.
Yeah. But that's not the last one. Yesterday, during the presentation by Jan Jacob Hoffman, someone fell asleep and started to snorkel.
Oh my gosh. It's just like Dave in the first year, he just came off the plane, just arrived here.
Yeah, I know.
And there was love stop.
Yeah.
Sometimes this is a bit hard. Something wrong.
Yes.
Seems a bit unfair.
But if he's not coming, someone switch on the microphone. Yeah, thank you. Hello, can you hear me? This is ZKM in Karlsruhe speaking. Okay, seems to work. Thank you.
Does it seem to work? Yeah. Well, hello and good morning to everyone here in ZKM and in European time zone. To everyone else, hello. Welcome back after hopefully a good night's sleep. This is the first talk in the first track at the lecture hall. And today it's going to be again Frans Adriansen. You know, it's another part of his huge program here. You know, yesterday he introduced Aliki, and then in the afternoon we had a nice workshop. And this afternoon there will be two more workshops or demos by Frans Adriansen at 4 p.m. and 5 p.m. about demonstration of violas and presentation of the results from the workshop yesterday. But now it's Frans Adriansen with his talk designing convolution engine optimized for Reverb.
Yeah, thank you, Eugenio. So, just one note for people who are following this through the streaming. The slides have been put up on the net by Frank 10 minutes ago. So if you didn't find them, you can find them now, probably. Okay, convolution engine for Reverb. We have already a number of convolution engines in Linux. The most famous one probably is Bootsphere, which has existed for a number of years and works quite well. That's by Anders Torger. Then Florian Schmidt wrote Jack and Wolf. And recently I added a little one of my own, which is called Jace. But there's no one of them that's really designed to be used easily as a program for music production. I want to reverb, click, click, here it is. You have to write scripts, launch the application, connect it, and so on. It's not really very practical. So I set out to write something that would make it practical. To disappoint you immediately, it's not finished. Some parts of it work, but I can't show it here. It's not in a state that I would like to show it. But try to tell something about the design and the problems that I encountered, because it's not an easy problem, really. Yeah, overview. We look into convolution for reverb. We'll have a look at how a real natural reverb works, what are the parts of it, and what's important in it. Then we go to the program, Aiella, that's again a Greek name. The general structure of it, what it's supposed to do. And then we look into the gory technical details of it. It uses convolution, partitioned convolution, but not with a constant size, as all the others up to now have done. And that can get quite complicated, as we will see. So, the principle of partitioned convolution in itself is not quite complex. It relies on three basic operations. We have forward FFTs, we have a multiply and sum operation, MAC, and you have inverse FFTs. And the complexity of each step is really proportional to the partition size. So what's a partition? I should maybe explain that. You have a very long impulse response, several seconds. You can't do the convolution for that whole thing in one time. The computation would be too complex, really. So it's sliced up in small parts, and these are called partitions. Typically, a few K samples, 2, 4, 8, 16, something like that. So, if we have NI inputs, NO outputs, the work to be done is this formula, which I will not try to repeat here. The conclusion is that the CPU load that you introduce depends on the partition size in such a way that if you make the partition size twice as short, the amount of work you have to do will double. That's the usual case. So what's the problem if you want a small CPU load? You would choose a large partition, but there's a price to pay, which is the delay. The processing delay can be zero if the partition size is the same as the period size that you use in your application. The Jacker also period size. Unfortunately, when you try to use a smaller period size, you get some delay, which will normally be the partition size minus the period size. Now, for some applications, you want a short delay, so there is a trade-off to be made here. If you use uniform partition sizes, so all the same, and you work with, say, a period size of 256 samples, which is typical, I think, the CPU load is much too high in most cases, so it's not really practical to do it. So we need another solution, and there is only one, which is to use not one size of partition, but different sizes. So the beginning of the impulse response is done with small partitions, and the end is done with larger ones. And that enables you to have zero delay and still a CPU load that is reasonable. As far as I know, There is no Linux application that does it that way at the moment. I could be mistaken, but I don't know it. It's even a bit more complicated if you use a reverb, for example, in an order session with Jack. You may want a negative processing delay, because if you go out of order into the reverb and back, there's a loop. And that loop will give you one period of delay, which you don't want. It seems impossible, but in case of reverb, it is actually possible to do that, as we will see. Now, to design such a reverb specific convolver, we have to look at what reverb is, really. If you have been at the workshop yesterday, you have seen some real impulse responses. This is just an abstract thing. It looks much too clean, of course. A real one is just a mess. What do we have? We produce a sound in a room. First thing you hear is the direct sound, straight from the instrument or the speaker or whatever to your ears. That's the first line here. Does it work? Yeah. It doesn't work. Fine, the line marked direct sound at time zero. Then the sound will bounce off against the walls, the roof, the ceiling, and you get a number of reflections, early reflections they are called in acoustics jargon. In general, that's everything that falls between 5 milliseconds and 52, maybe 100 milliseconds after the direct sound. And then you have a reverb tail, the number of reflections increases, it becomes, well, there could be thousands of them, so that will become one dense mass of reflections, and that's what you hear as the reverb. So, early reflections are in the start, 5 to 18 milliseconds, and you do not hear them as a separate sound. They merge with the direct sound. They give it more volume without increasing the real peak amplitude, which is interesting if you're mixing. They make it sound more real, and they also give you an impression of the shape and the size of the space where the sound is made. It's very important to do that. And the pattern of reflections depends very much on the position of the sound source. So if you make reflections that give a listener the idea that something is left, while you pan it right in your signal, that will not really work very well. So the reflections have to match the position of the source in your mix. If you want something that approaches the sound of a real hall, if you mix music that does not exist in real life in acoustic sense, it doesn't matter, of course. Then the reverb tail, that you hear as a separate sound. You're very conscious of it, that there is a reverb in the room. Normally the delay is exponential, it goes down in almost a straight line if you plot it on the decibel scale. That's the purple line here. It's not always the case. If you have a room with a complex shape, churches can be like that. You can have a reverb that starts, dies away and comes back second time, that sort of thing. But normally it's exponential. Again, the reverb tail depends on the source position. If you move just 10 centimeters, it's completely different. But the interesting thing is that you can't hear the difference. You can use the same reverb tail on all sources of your material, of your mix. As long as the early reflections are correct, it doesn't matter if you use the same reverb tail on all sound, because you can't hear the difference. And that's an important consideration when you look at what a reverb convolution should do, because then you get this sort of structure. There's a number, so the input is separated, really. Most reverb engines would have one input, or maybe two, stereo. Here you have separate inputs for the deflections, and there will be, there can be many. There could be one for the left, one for the center, one for the right. If you do surround, there will be separate early reflections input for the back and so on. So you send that from your mixer application, and you need really one cent per sector of your sound, really. Problem is that most mixer applications and DAWs do not support that way of working, or make it quite complicated to do it. Then you can mix all of them and send that to the reverb, to the reverb tail convolution, or you can have a separate input for that, which is sometimes interesting. You can modify the balance between the early reflections and the reverb tail. And then there's a third input, which is just direct sound, which goes through with a delay. Normally, you don't do that. Direct sound will be mixed already in your mixer, will be routed already in your mixer, provided you can have, you can do this with zero delay. If you can't do zero delay, you have to delay the direct sound as well. And that's why the direct sound input exists. In case when you configure the system in such a way that it can't do zero delay, it will put automatically the right delay into the direct sound path to compensate for it. So all the inputs here are just one mono, but all the rest, the convolution outputs could be stereo, ambisonics, 5.1, whatever. So it's really a multiple convolution. For example, if you have four early reflections inputs and the output is B format, the top block will contain 16 separate calculations. So what do we expect from such an application? It should be easy to use. Select a reverb like you select an effect in a plugin browser, that sort of thing. Configure it, so many channels, click and go. That's trademarked. It should support multi-channel surround format, because that's one thing I like to do. It should permit you to make a trade-off between CPU load and delay. You don't always need a minimum delay. In some cases, it just doesn't matter. In that case, you can spare some or a lot of CPU cycles accepting the delay. And one of the more difficult things, it should work with period sizes down to 64 without processing delay, which means that the first partition in the convolution will be 64 samples, which is very small. It should support the compensation for the loop delay, as I mentioned, and be usable both for natural reverb and effects. Most of the time you would use impulse responses to capture a real room, have a natural sound, but you can do wonderful things with synthetic impulse responses. And they are quite easy to generate. It's just a burst of noise in most cases, which you can shape and modify and filter and whatever. And each burst of noise will give you a different reverb. It's quite handy. And it should allow real-time modification of the reverb envelope. So normally it's fixed, you get that exponential thing. I plan to have some sort of graphical editor so you can modify the shape of that reverb. You could, for example, have something like a gated reverb, something that reverbs a certain time then cuts off very rapidly, as on drums. It's a bit fads in effect, but sometimes nice. Now, there's a problem. To have that zero delay, we need multiple partition sizes. And the result is that you can't, you don't have the same amount of calculation to do in each callback, in each period. And that's a problem, because the whole system based on callbacks, on synchronous processing of periods of sound, only works if all applications behave a bit and present more or less the same load to the system in each period. And that's no longer the case unless you work for, you design for it, really. Even using a partition size that's fixed, only one, but larger than the Jack period size, that already requires some careful planning. It's what happens in JACE, which allows you to use a small period size. You don't gain anything in delay by doing that in this case. If you use multiple sizes, things get complicated no end. When I started off thinking about this, it seemed not easy but doable. After a few evenings of thinking and making 100 drawings and sketches, it turned out that it's actually quite complicated. There are many things to take account of. Parameters that can change. Period size, okay, reasonable range is 64 to 2000, something like that. Maximum allowed delay, yeah, 0 to 100 milliseconds. Number of inputs and outputs, and then the length of convolutions. Things are easy if you have just one input, one output, and one convolution between them, but that's not reality. In most cases, you need a lot of them. The result is also that you will do multiple Fourier transform operations on the same data, just because you need the transforms with different sizes, which is in effect a waste of time. Could be avoided, maybe. And you get very complex buffering schemes because the impulse response is maybe a few seconds long, so a few hundred callbacks, and you have to buffer and manage all that data, and that by itself can get quite complex if you use multiple partition sizes. So it's a hard problem to get this right, and it has been researched for at least 15 years. With very few results, really, very few practical results. There was one practical result found by Bill Gardner 10 years ago. It's patented, but I don't think that's a problem for us because I don't use it really as he proposed it. That's like this. Suppose we have a convolution. We use partitions of one period and two periods. Yeah, the blue line here is the impulse response. So we have two partitions equal to the period size, and two of them double the period size. Then in even numbered cycles, I've indicated in each part here the work that can be started in that cycle. So the work can be started because all data is available, the input is available. So in the first cycle, we can start the convolution of partition A with cycle 0, that's the A0 thing here. The line indicates its place in the output. We can also start partition B on input 0, and that's all we can do at that moment. To do the convolutions C and D, we need at least two cycles of input. So that can only be done in the second cycle here. And then in the third cycle, which is again similar to the first one, we can only do two small partitions. So the result is that in the odd numbered cycles, we have three times the work that we have in the other ones. And this is only a simple example. It gets much, much worse if you use more partition sizes. What's the solution that Gardner found out? That is, under certain conditions, there's a systematic way to move the work. For example, if you see here the D01 convolution, so that's the convolution of partition D with input cycles 0 and 1. It can start in cycle 1, but we don't need the result there. We need the result only later in some following cycle. So we can postpone that work. And if we move this one here in the next cycle, and we do the same for all the others, so which means that this one is the one that came from the cycle above here. Yeah. So this one moves here. Then we have the same number, the same amount of work in each period. So that you can use with a small period size without overloading your system. And you can generalize that to more complex schemes. I leave it as an exercise to the listener to do this. Here we have four partition sizes. So A and B are of size one cycle, B, C, D, two cycles long, E, F are four cycles long. And the scheme here indicates how you can do that convolution in a cycle of four cycles, really, with a constant amount of work in each callback. It's not evident to find this out. You really have to puzzle it. But Gardner has shown that under certain conditions, it's always possible to find such a thing. And the condition is this structure. That's two of one size, two of a double size, two of four times, two of eight times, and so on. Under that condition, you can always find this sort of scheme. But that's too good, because Gardner, his solution was designed to work really on DSP hardware, where you process one sample at a time. There's no concept of block processing. There's only one input, one output, or maybe n inputs, n outputs with n convolutions in between, but not a complete matrix. So you can generalize it to something that will work in all cases. And that's a big problem. Normally, most applications, and Reverb is like that, you have n inputs, n e inputs, n o outputs, and you have the product of those two number of convolutions to perform. That's a completely different situation. And the conclusion is, and I've searched the literature for that, and you find almost nothing. There is no simple algorithm, or even a complicated one, that will tell you how to organize the work while respecting real-time constraints. It is a difficult problem, it is not solved. In the paper, there's one reference to a paper about this, which is more recent than Gardner, 2002, I believe. If you read that, you will see how complex it can become, and even that is not a complete solution. So, what is the practical solution then? That's to observe that not all the work that can be started in a certain period needs to be finished in that period. And that means we can shift it to another thread which doesn't have the same real-time constraints as the callback one. And what you need to do in that case is shift as much work that can be delayed to other threads. And if you can ensure that the work that remains in the callback is less than the average, then you don't lose any processing power by doing it. Suppose the ideal condition would be this. You have the same work in each callback, 50% of your CPU load, which means 50% is free for other applications here to do real-time work. This is what you get if you try to do convolution with multiple partition sizes. In one cycle, you have lots of work, second cycle, almost nothing, and so on, and then you get a pattern that will repeat. So the problem here is that all the applications can only take this space, which is maybe 10%, which is available. If they go above that, the system will fail, only in that cycle, but that's enough. So what can we do? We move part of the work to other threads, which don't have to terminate within the callback. And that's the green part here. So suppose we have moved the green part of the work to other one or more other threads, and what remains in the callback is the red thing. In this case, we still have the same processing capacity as this one, at least, and maybe better. What will happen if there's an application that takes more than this time, another one, then the green part of the work will just shift to the next cycle. But it will not overload your system. And since it doesn't have to terminate in this cycle, there's no problem, unless things get very bad. And the work that needs to be terminated, if it is less than the average, okay, then your performance, the processing power that remains is at least as much as here. The result is that if your system fails, the one using these extra threads will be the first to fail, of course. But the total capacity for the callback itself will not be impaired. It's at least as good as in the perfect case. So in a practical way, how do you do this? There's a lot of data management in a convolution engine. You have lots of buffers, input, outputs, intermediate results, and so on, which are normally used in some circular fashion. So there's a lot of management of buffer sizes and that sort of thing. The only sane way to program it, according to me, is in an object style, really, that you abstract all the details and get a clean interface to it. Now we have different threads running on the same object. That's the way I implemented it, and it works quite well, really. You still can control it. This is one of the cases where I would allow different threads to use shared data. Normally you don't do it, because it complicates your design. In this case, you have to. So you have here the Jack thread, which will wake up, call your process callback. And when it returns from the process, it will trigger one or several more other threads, which will be waiting here to do other parts of the work, the parts that were in green in the previous picture. And as long as these ones terminate, do their work in time, but it doesn't have to be the same period, everything works fine. So that's how the prototype code at the moment works. So what is the state of this thing? So what's the solution I used in the end? For the early reflections, all the small convolutions, the one that you need for zero delay, they are done in the process callback using a scheme that looks a bit like the one Gardner proposed, but it's different enough not to have problems with the patent. Then the large partitions for the early reflections go to extra threads, which just run at their own pace. And the work for the reverb tail is all of it is done in separate threads which run in real time, but just take their time, and as long as your system is not overloaded, the results will be there in time. There are some extra complications. If you send work to a helper thread, a large partition, when it is ready to be executed, and if the partition is really quite large, say 16K, that's 1/3 of a second. That thread that's running in real time will block your machine for 1/3 of a second. No problem for the audio, but there's a problem for your user interface, for example, which at that time becomes rather slow and unresponsive. So you have to split up the work done on these large partitions into small parts and trigger them each separately from the process callback. Otherwise you get a system that is not really very interactive anymore. Then I have allowed real-time modification of the impulse responses. That complicates things a bit, because you have to coordinate that work in the different threads. They all have to use the same data for the same part of the signal, which they don't handle at the same time, and so on and so on. The process callback should never wait for those other threads. When they fail softly, but they don't lock up your system, at least. So, what's the state of this thing? DSP code works in a sort of test bench mode, which allows me to trace what's happening inside. What happens, the complex scheduling inside, the scheduling that happens in the buffer allocation and management is so complex that I couldn't really test this thing in real-time mode or debug it in real-time mode. It was hell. So it works at the moment, but sort of offline. Then there's the application framework and the graphical user interface, which is in a separate process. That was another exercise I wanted to add for this application. They are nearly finished, but the two don't know each other, so I have to bring everything together at the moment. What will happen to this project depends to some extent on the Free Impulse project, which I announced yesterday. What I expect to happen is that lots of people will measure impulse responses, put them in the right format, put them on the website here, so that users of this program have a large collection to select from. Otherwise, such a program has no use, really. So everything will depend on the success of this ID. So, since I can't show you the program itself, I give you a substitute, just a small convolution delay demo, which is done with JS as a plugin in Arder. It's an impulse response I got from Professor Farina. It's a church in Italy called Santa Lucia. That's all I know. But it sounds as a church, anyway. If you don't like the music, it's not that long. I selected this because it's a rather dry recording. There's a bit of reverb on it, but not very much, so we can play with it. If you play this in a church, which is a bad idea from a musical point of view, but you could do it for an effect, get this. Which sounds nice to me. It's to be quite difficult to use a normal reverb to do this, if you listen carefully. So this is a mix of the direct sound here in Arder and the reverb tail, which is done by convolution. And this is the same thing without the direct sound. So the convolution only makes the reverb and the reflections. So this sounds really very distant, of course. If you have followed Jan Jacob's talk on ambisonics, he mentioned the way to suggest a distance from a source. Changing this relation, of course, does it. At the piano at the moment. So, that's it. If you have any questions, I will be happy to answer them. Thank you. Yeah, there's already one.
So, if you have questions, please would you shout out so I can find you?
Yep.
Over here, in the center of the room.
Okay, come away. Oh, talk again.
Here.
Just pause on the mic, yeah, okay, fine.
Sorry if this is a stupid question, but you mentioned that there's no algorithm for determining the optimal scheme.
Yeah.
Computation. But maybe I misunderstood, but isn't the scheme that would be optimal only depends on the partition you use for the impulse response. If that's the case, you could do the computation offline and determine the optimal scheme offline and then use that online.
Yes, that's one way to do it. That's what I do in JS, really. You select a period size and a partition size. You know, the program will think for a moment and try to find a scheme to distribute the partition over a number of callbacks. But it depends on a lot of things that you don't know exactly. What is the processing time for one FFT? What is the processing time for one MAC? It depends on the platform, depends on your CPU, depends on a lot of things. So unless you start measuring those things, you don't have the right information to do it, really. But that's one way to do it, yes. Just find out, think about it, find the scheme, maybe optimize it a bit, shift things until they fit. Yeah. But it only works if your information is accurate as to the complexity of each step. And the problem with that is if you use a very small period size, 64 periods, that sort of thing, there's not much room for to make mistakes.
Okay, thank you.
Yep.
There is a question at the front.
Question at the front.
From Norway. There's one thing I was wondering. You are using this as a reverb. You have
yep.
the direct sound, and you use this process to add the reflections and the reverb.
Yeah.
But when you measure an impulse response, you also have the direct sound in the impulse response.
Yes.
Isn't it quite difficult to remove that?
No, if you've been at the workshop today, yesterday.
It's I was not.
It's just two or three mouse clicks away and it's gone. You just indicate it on the graphical display where it is, that range, cut it off and that's it.
Yes, but then you are dependent upon having a room impulse response where there is some delay between the direct sound and the first reflection.
There always should be. Ah, I forgot.
The floor reflection
yes,
but very close in time.
Yeah, a floor reflection can be very close in time, but I mentioned the negative delay thing. One reason why you can do this, so compensate for the loop delay, is that you can, in practice, cut the first 5-6 milliseconds of the IR, of the impulse response. Do the direct sound directly through your normal mixing, and you don't lose anything, really. The floor reflection, if it exists, most of the time, it's not something you want. Your room will probably sound better without it.
It will sound less real, probably. Now I see your point.
But you can normally forget the first at least 5 milliseconds of the impulse response, which gives the convolver time to use that 5 to 6 milliseconds of delay and still be in time. Yeah, you cut off the start.
I see this separation is very useful for this kind of use, where you use it as a reverb effect.
Mm-hmm.
So that I'm more used to using the whole impulse response and no direct sound.
Oh yeah, but it depends on the application, of course. But this program is designed to be used as a reverb, really. It could be used for other purposes, of course.
It was very interesting.
Thank you.
Any more questions?
Yeah, one in the back.
Back, I'm coming. Shout again, please.
It's you.
Yes. Florian Schmitz, German. I have a question about failing softly.
Yep.
Is that really a good idea? I do the same thing in the ESI convolve, and I don't really know if it's such a good thing, because if you do like some processing recording and you fail softly and you don't recognize it.
Yes.
It's really a big problem.
Yeah.
Is it, if you put up the load to another thread,
mm-hmm.
How do you say it? Is it really such a good idea to fail softly?
I don't really see an alternative. I don't see a good alternative to it. In many cases, for example, you're mixing something, you have an impulse response of a second. Say that at a certain time, the last 200 milliseconds of your reverb is missing. It's missing because the thread was not in time. Will it harm? Probably not. Right. If there's enough noise of other sources, you won't notice it. In the other case, if you make it a heart failure, then okay, the whole thing stops really. You're finished. The idea I had is to make it soft fail, but to indicate it on the screen. Something will flash quite heavily to indicate that things are not okay.
Any more questions, perhaps from the internet?
No. Okay.
Okay, thank you. Then I think we should end the question and answer session now. I mean, there's probably time for some more private talk. So now we'll have a quarter hour break. Then there will be the next talk here. This is Josh Green. And I should mention that today we have two tracks. There's another track over in the media theater. I think there's no talk at 12. I think that was cancelled. If it was Darwin Johnson,
oh, sorry.
It was cancelled. But
no,
there
is a talk.
Okay, there is a talk. There are.
The talk 11:30 has been cancelled.
11:30. Okay. Okay, then. Thank you, everyone. Thank you, Fons. Great
you.
Talk.
Thank you.
Okay.
Okay. And
testing. Testing. Hello. Hello. All right. Have some time.
You were saying before that we stop.